Session number 26581.
Group Captain Eccles, Reel 2. We were talking about your time training there on the twin engine Oxfords at RAF College Cranwell. Can you take me through the different types of flying training they put you through? Because it wasn't all just basic flying then, they were actually teaching you different aspects of flying, weren't they?
Yes. To start with, of course, I was simply learning to fly the aircraft. And that included eventually getting onto things like a night flying test and a navigation test and low flying.
Well, take us through them. So what was night flying like in the Oxford? I mean, what instruments did you have? How did you manage?
Well, it was wartime, and therefore we were in blackout conditions. So that night flying right from the beginning was genuine night flying, in which instrument flying was essential. We practiced instrument flying in the daytime and just used the same at night.
Now, what instruments did you have at that point?
Well, the standard instrument panel of an RAF aircraft with artificial horizon and turn and bank and directional gyro and so on.
And so, navigation. How did you navigate? What did you have, navigational aids, or was it still a matter of looking out the side?
Well, navigation was entirely a matter of what's known as DR navigation, in which you are doing, as you're flying the aircraft yourself, you're doing mental navigation in the sense of having previously worked out on the ground the track you want to make good. You then have to work out also the effect of the wind, and you maintain that track. Then, with the aid of a map, you check that you are on track from land point, from fixes that you get on the ground.
Could you see, I mean, was you could see, what were the most helpful geographical features or man-made features from the air that helped you best fix your position on the map?
Well, of course, the great cheating system was to fly a Bradshaw route, which was simply to follow the railway from A to B. But that wasn't part of our navigation test. In the navigation test, which was a kind of a triangular cross country, the turning points would have been chosen to be reasonably easy to identify. I remember one was a flour mill, which was a white building which could be seen from quite a distance. Rivers are very good aids to navigation because, unlike railways, which are straight, rivers have bends in them, and the bend helps you to identify just what part of the river you're over.
And what were the cross-country flights out there? Would you do a lot of cross-country flights?
No. One or two. On one occasion, I well remember, it was a cross-country flight in which we had to land at another airfield, or I had to land at another airfield. And in my inexperience, I carefully looked to see which way the T was to show the direction of the wind, and then chose to land downwind. The wing commander flying at that particular airfield didn't like what I had done, as it was an operational airfield. And I was having lunch in the mess, and he sent for me. And it so happened that I was still doing my flying training and hadn't got my wings, but on the other hand, I was a commissioned officer. And he couldn't understand how a commissioned officer without wings was flying an aeroplane and landing on his airfield. But he did help him to understand why I landed downwind.
Could you just explain, I mean, I know, but could you explain why you shouldn't have landed downwind?
Well, you land into wind so that your ground speed on touchdown is as low as possible. If you land downwind, it's as fast as possible. After some 60 hours flying, I obtained a proficiency as a pilot on type as average, and then went on to the advanced training school at the RAF College, where I learnt to fly the Oxford in a more military application of the aircraft.
So tell me about that. Does this mean bombing?
It was bombing, it was doing a certain amount of more advanced navigation, it was flying with another student, where we worked together, a little bit of anti-aircraft work, that is assuming that we were being under anti-aircraft fire, taking evasive action.
Now, tell me about the bombing side of it. What, I mean, you weren't actually practicing bombing runs then, were you?
Yes, we carried out bombing, low-level bombing, dropping practice bombs on a field where there was a target that was used specifically for this purpose.
Now, how would you do that? I mean, who dropped the bombs? Was that the pilot had the controls?
Yes, it was low-level bombing, and it was done by the pilot by eye.
So no, we're not talking any
no
devices.
Bomb sites, no. But we did also do high-level bombing, but this was not dropping actual bombs, but on what was called the camera obscura. And the camera obscura was a device that enabled somebody on the ground to see on a planning table what was virtually a photographic image of what was happening up in the sky. So you flew using a bomb sight over a target, and when you press the button to drop the bomb, a light flashed, and down on the ground they could see the flashing light and calculate the accuracy of the bomb drop.
With the navigational, the advanced navigation, were there any of the devices or other means of navigation, or was it just more practice of the same?
It was more practice of the same, because I go to a navigation school later on.
Right, we'll leave, we'll come to that then.
Also included in the advanced trainings course was doing short takeoffs and landings and aerial photography.
And tell me about the aerial photography, because that had been very important in the First World War, but almost seems neglected in the Second World War.
Well, it wasn't actually at all neglected in World War II. PRU, the Photographic Reconnaissance Unit, carried out some extremely valuable reconnaissance using many of them cases of Spitfires, but that's another story.
Now tell me about the training you had.
Oh, this was simply doing line overlaps with a camera fitted in the aircraft, which was that we simply flew from A to B and photographed as we flew, keeping a straight line the whole time. Well, I suppose probably over a period of about 10 miles.
And was that? That was to create a sort of a chain of photographs.
Yes, yes.
Was it done automatically, the gap? Because that would be the skill, or was it? Or would you trigger each photograph?
I think we triggered each photograph. Yes, I'm sure it did. Later on, this was done automatically, but at this time, it was. I think part of the exercise, in fact, was being able to make sure your line overlaps were correct.
Now, you also mentioned you practiced evasive action as if you were under anti-aircraft. Now, what sort of evasive techniques?
It was very nominal. It was only steep turns. It was a waste of time.
Anything else while you were there?
We did some formation flying practice.
How difficult or easy was formation flying? Because this would be your first time, wouldn't it?
Yeah, formation flying was a little bit like driving a car behind another car without any brakes. You get used to it after a time, but to start with, when you're getting into pretty close formation, you really don't have anything like the ability to, as you do in a car, just to put your foot on the brakes and slow down a bit. You've got to anticipate a little bit in advance whether you're gaining on the aircraft or losing on it. The response to throttle settings is not immediate.
Anything else?
We also did a certain amount of training in reconnaissance. Yes, I can remember that on one occasion I did a reconnaissance of RAF Finningley. They were very simple exercises in which we were expected to identify and calculate the number of aircraft on the airfield.
But look, this wasn't a photograph. This was just...
This was visual reconnaissance.
Anything else?
No.
So you were there, roughly speaking, from November 39 through till, looks like the summer, May somewhere...
June.
Till June.
The 1st of June 39, I was assessed at the completion of my time at Cranmore.
Now, what was the assessment like? What were they looking at? How did they do it?
It was simply an assessment of ability as a pilot, as a navigator, in bombing and in air gunnery. And in each case, it was average.
Now, was average the average score? If you, I know that's...
I've no idea. Couldn't
you don't
tell
know
you.
The answer.
It didn't mean anything to me whether it was average or above average.
Now, was this the point at which you got your wings?
No, I think I got my wings at the end of the first training period before going to the advanced training school.
Right. Now, your next posting on 7th of June 1940 was to the number one school of general reconnaissance at Guernsey. And you were only there for, about 2 weeks from the looks of things. But this was for... What course were you doing there?
The general reconnaissance course is the introduction to coastal command, navigation, ship recognition and so on, anti-submarine warfare. The reason why we were only at Guernsey for 2 weeks was that the Germans didn't allow us to stay any longer. And we left in rather a hurry and they moved in virtually the next day.
Well, tell me first what you were learning there, and then secondly we'll look at this business of the Germans arrived. What exactly were you doing? You weren't flying, were you? There's nothing in your logbook.
No, the first couple of weeks of the course were concerned with matter of codes and ciphers, ship recognition, aircraft recognition, navigation.
Well, let's take codes and ciphers. How far were you? Why did you need to know codes and ciphers?
Because in coastal command, it's necessary that if you're sending any information from an aircraft to a base, it has to be coded for security.
And which type of code were you using?
There were really two kinds of... there were codes and ciphers.
What is the difference?
Well,
I'm sorry to be so...
Yes. In one case, the code was a voice code, which and also for WT, simply to abbreviate, rather like people do today with messages on mobile phones. Simply to get information through in a very simple way, like QFE and QGH and things like that, the Q code. The other system was what was known as the PSYKO, S-Y-K-O, and this was a coding system that used a device you carried in the aircraft with you, and it was a question of having written your message out in English, you then... translated it by pushing down bars and getting coded letters instead, and then the codes were sent out in that form and then deciphered at the other end.
Now, aircraft recognition, how far were you going into that?
Well, aircraft recognition covered everything in the sense of military aircraft of our own and of the enemy.
Did you find it easy? Some people seem to just be able to do it, others have a lot of trouble distinguishing.
There was no trouble at all. I suppose maybe because I was naturally always very interested in aircraft, I'd always been able to recognise them. Sorry, I'd always been able to recognise them. In the 30s, I was an avid follower of the King's Cup Air Race and went down to Woodford Airfield near Manchester. And I could recognise all the different types of aircraft there. So it was a natural for me.
You knew most of it already. Now, what else were you doing before the Germans intervened there?
Enjoying the beach.
Where actually was it at Guernsey?
We bought a car for, I think, 30 shillings between four of us. And we each had a driving licence, which I think cost something like a shilling for life in Guernsey. It certainly wasn't very much. And we drove this car around Guernsey to go to beaches and pubs. And when we left in a hurry, we had to get rid of it. So we drew lots as to who was going to drive it over the cliff. And I was the fortunate one. This was an old car that had an accelerator on the steering wheel. and I put the car into speed and jumped out and left it to go over the cliff, but unfortunately it hit a tuft of grass and came round back again. So somebody else had a go. And it did go over the edge, but it really wasn't at all spectacular.
A bit of a disappointment.
It was just a heap with a lot of steam coming up at the bottom of the cliff. Didn't look terribly bent at all.
Now, whereabouts were you on Guernsey? I should have asked earlier. I mean,
we were on the airfield at Guernsey, and I was billeted in the Manor Hotel nearby.
Comfortable billet?
It was a small holiday hotel. I don't know, the pre-war, it wasn't a terribly extravagant affair. And just down the road was an extremely delightful little beach, a cove, Petit Beau, I think its name was, where you could get drinks, which were extremely cheap. A complete round of drinks was a shilling.
Now, how did the Germans intervene in this idyll? How did you know they were coming? I mean, had they actually landed or started to, in any way to attack before you left, or did you leave before anything happened?
Actually, I must have done some flying at Guernsey, because I can remember seeing the smoke of Dunkirk in the distance. And it wasn't a surprise when we were told at 3 o'clock in the afternoon that we were to be off on the 5 o'clock boat. And that was, in fact, the last boat out of Guernsey.
Was it a very hurry? I mean, did you have time to get all your stuff packed and away?
I suppose the answer to that is yes. We didn't have all that much stuff anyway.
So, from there, no trouble on the way back? You weren't attacked by air or anything?
No. We had a perfectly comfortable journey back and were sent on leave.
And then your next thing was a... seemed to be the reformed number one school.
Yes, we reformed under canvas again at Hooton Park. And then after a while, the number one school of general reconnaissance at Hooton Park went off to South Africa, and we were then sent to the, I think, number three school of general reconnaissance at Blackpool, at Squire's Gate.
There's nothing particular to report from your time at number one school. You were only with them a month after you got back.
No, nothing. We just were doing our normal course of curriculum, and it was clearly temporary until things were sorted out.
And what about the number three school? That was at...
That was at Squire's Gate in Blackpool. And we went on there to complete the course.
What was the setup like there?
We were billeted in boarding houses. I suppose maybe three or four of us in a boarding house. I can remember the name of the boarding house I was in was called Marcyn, M-A-R-C-Y-N, because Mary and Cynthia were his daughters. And it was more or less on the front at Blackpool.
Now, was anything new? Was it more of the same, or were you getting anything new there?
Well, we were getting something new in the sense that as the course went on, it became more intense and more advanced. We also, of course, had the full facility of enjoying life in Blackpool, because we were commissioned, and Blackpool was also an ITW, and it was full of airmen. And all airmen had to be in camp by 11 p.m. We, as officers, didn't have to be in at any time at all. And I can remember on one occasion, we decided that we would have a dinner party in the winter gardens at Blackpool, about a dozen or so of us. And I rang the Grand Theatre, I think it was the Grand Theatre, where Happy Drome was on, and asked if a dozen of the chorus girls would like to join us for dinner, which they did, and we had a great evening. Also, at that particular time when I went to the theatre to pick them up, Blackpool was being bombed.
Was it bombed much?
No, just a bit of shrapnel fell around. I can't remember any bombs falling on Blackpool, but I just remember the air raid siren going off and a lot of noise.
You were learning navigate. I mean, you were on general reconnaissance. I mean, how far were you going with navigation by this stage? Because
the flying was almost entirely navigational flying exercises of DR, dead reckoning navigation, of different forms, one of another.
Now, what would a typical navigation, what would one of these navigational exercises be like?
A typical exercise would be a triangular flight. Going to, say, Liverpool, then out to the Isle of Man, and then back to Blackpool.
Was there a lot of it oversea?
Oh, it was all oversea.
That you couldn't cheat?
Yeah, it was all oversea. And we also learnt to do basic measurement of drift.
Now, how did you measure drift? Because, I mean, what was the method of measuring drift?
Well, the official method of measuring drift was through a thing called a tail drift sight, a TDS. In which you, it was a bit like a rear-facing periscope looking down, and you picked up you started with a white horse immediately below you, and followed it back. And as you followed it back, it made an angle with the aircraft, and that was your drift.
So quite a simple device.
Very simple device, but in fact, most of my time later on, when I was flying in Coastal Command, as we flew almost entirely to 1,000 feet, I used to measure drift by observing the seahorses and the wind lanes. And the wind lanes. When you're flying over the sea and there's a wind blowing, it creates a kind of a ripple effect, like a lot of lines which you can see, and those are downwind, so they give you the direction of the wind. Now, if there are no white horses, then the wind strength is less than 10 knots. If there are a few white horses, then it's about 10 to 12, 15 knots. And if there are a lot of white horses, it's more than that. So you can estimate the wind strength and direction by observing the wind lanes and observing the sea state.
You never had to use the TDS? Or would you use that to check it?
We did use it. We used a TDS for getting more accurate measurements of the wind speed and direction by a triangulation system, which was one of the things we learned at the school.
Now, what else were you doing on all these navigational exercises? Any other skills that were teaching you?
It was in the ground subjects were not carried out into the air. The flying was entirely with navigation. On one or two occasions, we were expected to identify some of the shipping in the off Liverpool, but that was not of great importance.
So a lot of it was repetition to get better, quicker, yeah, and more accurate.
Yes.
So you weren't there that long. You were there till October, from the looks of things.
Yes, I was there longer than my colleagues, in fact, because I went ill in the middle and had bilateral maxillary sinusitis.
Was that made worse by your flying, or triggered by your flying?
I suppose you could say it was triggered in the sense that it was extremely uncomfortable to fly under that condition, and that's why I reported sick.
Did it just make it hurt when the pressure changed?
Well, yes. I mean, in fact, the infection was such that I was under a certain amount of pain the whole time, not just when I was flying, but on the ground. And I eventually went into hospital and had an operation, which was included a washout, which is a most unpleasant experience. The only advantage to it was the fact that the young doctor, who was a friend of my sister's, who was also a doctor, looked after me by seeing that I had a certain amount of brandy available. And on one occasion, he carried a nurse in his arms and dropped her on my bed and said, she's just had her appendix out and needs the exercise.
So you weren't suffering too much, then?
No.
So in October, you went, and now this unit, I don't quite understand, it's number one... bracket COTU. Is that the Bourne Coastal Command?
Yes, Operational Training Unit.
And that was at...
Silloth.
Silloth. Where's Silloth?
Silloth is in Cumberland.
Now, tell me what you were doing here.
I was learning to fly Hudson aircraft.
And, tell me what the Hudson was like to fly, because I presume you
do. Well, the Hudson, of course, was considerably larger than the Oxford that I'd learned to fly on as a twin-engine aircraft. And the Hudson was, in fact, the RAF military version of the American civil airliner, the Lockheed 14. The airfield at Silloth was a bit primitive. We did have a runway, but there were no hard standings. And in the winter months, there was a great deal of mud. In fact, it was amazing at times taxiing aircraft out of the mud when you needed full throttle just to get moving. On one occasion, I had as an instructor for a short time a gentleman of the name of Moll, M-O-L-L, a Dutchman, because he and Parmentier had flown in the famous London-Australia race before the war and came in second.
Now, what did you think of the Hudson to fly?
Well, the Hudson was a grand aeroplane. It was, in those days, really quite a sophisticated aircraft. It had an automatic pilot that was extremely effective. It had a certain amount of crew comfort. And although, it, in a way, for some people it was a bit tricky to fly, I thoroughly enjoyed flying a Hudson.
Now, why did some people find it difficult?
The Hudson had a great tendency to swing on takeoff and swing on landing. And if you weren't able to hold the swing, you could finish up by going off the runway and the undercarriage collapsing and the struts going up through the wing and the aircraft catching fire.
It's a fairly serious thing. Yeah. How did you hold it straight? Well, was it just a matter of strength or anticipation?
No, it was a question of anticipating the swing and just stopping it happening.
So once you knew it was going to happen, you could act to stop it before it happened?
Well, it always does happen with the rotation of the engines. You just had to be prepared for it. And also is the fact that American aircraft engines turn one way and British aircraft engines turn the other. So on a British aircraft, the aircraft swings one way, and on the American aircraft, it swings the other way.
But other than that, you enjoyed flying it. What made an aircraft good to fly, in your view?
I suppose, actually, the flying of them was very much the same. It was the comfort. It was being able to fly in warmer conditions with less noise and a more relaxed manner, and able to use the autopilot to take the load off.